Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Patrick Brenner. I'm the president of the Southwest Public Policy Institute. I'm pleased to be joined today by our vice president of research and the host of SPPI TV, Daoud Muska.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Patrick. Good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon.
I get up late today.
That's fine. So today, episode 8, Small Reactors, Big Potential, Unleashing the Power of Nuclear Energy. I'm really excited that we are joined today by Mark Nelson from Radiant Energy Group, Gareth Thomas from Holtec International, and Philip Ord of Americans for Nuclear Energy. Folks, thanks so much for joining us today. I'm going to turn it over to you, Daoud. Take it away.
Thank you, Patrick. And I will, by way of introduction, I will just explain where I'm coming from. We have some experts in this field. I'm a expert on energy policy. These guys are experts on the science and technology and engineering of all this, which makes them far, far smarter than I am. My introduction to the nuclear field actually occurred when I was at university, when the Connecticut Hazardous Waste Management Service decided to site a low-level radioactive waste dump about a half a mile from my family farm's orchard. So nuclear issues have been very, very big in my life, and I've gotten to really do the nuclear tour. I've even stood atop Yucca Mountain, where much of our spent fuel was supposed to go from our nuclear reactors in our country. And that's a project that's fraught with its own issues here in the American Southwest. I want to thank our gentlemen for joining us this morning. Nuclear power, nuclear generated electricity. It seems to me that in a fractious time in our country, a very fractious time, when we're at each other's throats, anyone who really looks objectively at the data and at the potential, at the past and at what we're doing now and what we possibly can do in the future, should be very, very high on nuclear technology. I'm thinking of two groups primarily. You have the people who have embraced this narrative of climate change. I am not one of them. I think it's insane, frankly. I don't think the world's going to end in 9 years, unlike many of my fellow Americans. Nuclear power, of course, does not produce carbon dioxide when it produces electricity. So it seems to me that's a natural attraction for that group of Americans. The other group of Americans, people on the right, of course, not very... the environmentalist message doesn't resonate very well with those, but people on the right are concerned about the intermittency of solar and wind. They're concerned about the cost of solar and wind. People on the right think about just the efficiency and the cost of just the engineering and how useful the science and technology is. They tend to embrace technology more than some of our more Luddite Americans. Nuclear should be extremely attractive to them. I'm a libertarian. I would call myself an original environmentalist. I care about pollution, air pollution, water pollution, and I care about habitat preservation. I don't think the world's coming to an end in 9 years. Nuclear fits into my paradigm extremely well for its small footprint. And of course, it doesn't release nasty things like nitrous oxides and sulfur dioxide and lead and mercury and all that kind of thing. Why can't we all come together on this? It seems to be a natural common ground from whatever your perspective is. And that's what I really want to stress today with our three guests. Basically, how nuclear, small modular reactors, but just nuclear technology at large, how it really represents an opportunity for those of us, the 99.999% of Americans who use electricity and want to continue to use electricity, can come together on something that solves a lot of problems. Even if we don't even agree on what those problems are, nuclear technology should be attractive to all thinking Americans. That's my little soliloquy to start the conversation. And we won't get into the ideology of our guests. We're going to stick to the science and the technology of this. I'm going to start with we'll start with Gareth from Holtec. Gareth, nuclear technology is, when we produce nuclear power from uranium, basically a mineral from the earth, nuclear power plants are basically, in no way to diminish the fine work you folks do, but they're basically sophisticated ways to make hot water to produce steam to run a steam turbine. Tell us a little bit, sort of community college, junior college 101, what goes on inside a nuclear reactor to make all of that heat, to heat all that water.
Yeah, so I mean, like you said, it's just a really fancy kettle. All we're trying to do is make hot water, right? I mean, and I'm talking about the current fleet. I know there's some new technologies out there, but you know, especially current fleet and what Holtec is doing with our new small modular reactor design is we're taking uranium fuel rods. They're assembled into bundles, so you can pick up, you know, many rods at the same time and handle them easily. And then you assemble them all together in a pressure vessel. You fill it with water, you pressurize the water so that the water doesn't boil under high pressure. And then you start a chain reaction in the uranium. So you have self-sustaining chain reaction of neutrons hitting into these uranium atoms, causing fission. Neutrons from that go on to the next one, and it's just a nice steady power coming out of the reactor. So basically all you're doing is heating up these uranium rods, and the rods are getting hot. They're passing that heat into the water. The water gets hot, several hundred degrees Celsius, and it's passing that in that heat into a secondary heat exchanger. It's boiling water in our case in a steam generator, and then that steam goes to a turbine, and you're just at that point, it's just a conventional power plant, right? You're just generating steam using this different process, but it's reliable, and we've been doing it for, well, since the 1940s, right? So it's really a very well-known technology. The processes, the calculations, it's all been done for many, many decades. All we're trying to do now is do it in a cost-efficient way that can be supported by private industry, and in a way that is obviously safe and driving down that risk profile.
Sure, sure. I'm glad you mentioned history, because, of course, here in the Southwest, New Mexico, Nevada, we have a little bit of nuclear history. And so we have a lot of folks watching today who probably had their careers with private entities, but also, of course, the federal government. Mark, SMR, small modular reactor. We're going to get into some more details about what Holtec is doing, but talk about this new concept of these smaller facilities, and what was the origin of this, and what are we looking at in terms of ideally moving forward, these types of reactors, I guess, occupying more of a market share in the nuclear field?
Well, fortunately, we've always had small modular reactors. We've had them in the past. We have them now. We'll have them in the future. Multiple countries operate them. We didn't call them SMRs. That's a recent marketing term, mainly from people who, in my opinion, don't understand the engineering. But because people have started hearing SMRs, everyone wants to use the phrase SMR. Sure. So when Holtec says we have an SMR, well, sure, they have a small reactor, but there are many small reactors. So, for example, just about 10 days ago, I was visiting a real-life SMR fleet that is powering the nation of Slovakia. They have reactors of exactly the same size as the SMRs being proposed in the UK by Rolls-Royce. And it's just basically a way to make smaller amounts of power. I think people get too hung up on whether it'll have different features or this or that. Basically, nuclear is pretty good. And from the outside, people aren't really going to be able to tell much of a difference. So I think that that's the most important thing to know. And as long as you talk to people who aren't trying to sell an individual SMR, you'll get that pretty straight answer. So in my opinion, nuclear is basically all good. Different reactor designs may have different qualities. In general, I trust what we can hear about reactors that already exist a little bit more than ones that don't exist. But just like the ones we already have are absolutely fantastic and are beloved parts of their communities, I suspect that the new reactors are going to be fantastic too.
Great. And I thank you for both of you for your clarifying any confusion I was offering. In America, we in the mid-1970s, nuclear in terms of its regeneration of electricity was still in the single digits. We peaked out about 20.1% of our juice was produced by nuclear in 1995. In 2021, these are federal statistics, not mine, we were down to 18.9%, which is still pretty impressive, almost one in five electrons produced by nuclear power, despite the fact that many actual nuclear facilities, either individual reactors or plants themselves, have shut down. If Phil is on the if we are able to talk to Phil, I'd like to ask him a question on the American side. Can these smaller reactors, can they play a role with our existing reactors? Can they grow that percentage, I guess, because we've lost a couple percentage points over the last couple of decades, and is there a role for those smaller reactors augmenting the sort of big super systems we have right now?
I think so, and especially in some of our kind of smaller fossil generators, we could begin to replace them with smaller reactors, but we also need to, you know, upgrade and replace the ones that need that are too old to function anymore. But these plants can last, you know, up to like 80 years. A lot of them are probably going to end up going for 80 years. We need to be able to replace, we need to be able to build more large reactors too. So, I mean, the thing about small modular is it's just a way, the idea behind that is to make it more like manufacturable in a factory. So you can make modules over and over and over again in a factory line, kind of like the Boeing airplane factory in Washington. And that would, the idea is that that would limit the amount of on-site construction you'd have to do. But yes, absolutely, they can augment our current system, and especially go to areas that just don't necessarily need a whole megawatt of, a whole gigawatt of power. So that's how I understand it.
Sure. Gareth, explain a little more about that modular element of SMR, the idea of that this is a different way of building a reactor as opposed to that old way where they were more bespoke plants that oftentimes, you know, construction went over budget, and of course the regulators had their role. What is the potential advantage here, economies of scale of building these, of laying these out, rolling these out, sort of more of a factory line? I know it'll never be like producing widgets, but what is the advantage of the modular part of small modular reactor?
So ultimately, you're trying to get your cost down, right? So the more times you build the same thing, you know, your cost just starts to come down because you start to learn, you start to improve, you start to have efficiencies both in time to do an operation, and then you learn a faster way to do that same activity. So what we're trying to do is essentially do the same thing over and over again and learn and drive costs down. Well, the problem we've had with nuclear up until now is, as you alluded to, we built a few and then we tweaked and changed and then we just kept like changing the designs, and really we never really got to see that true cost benefit. I mean, the greatest example with large nuclear is the French, right? The French fleet, where they did mass produce the same reactor types, and they for a long time had the cheapest electricity in Europe. And so that's really what we're trying to do, but on a smaller scale. Do I fundamentally believe that, you know, the whole plant can be built in a factory? No. I mean, it's just not the case. So we will have to do a lot of civil construction, and there's still going to be a lot of on-site activity. However, really, we're trying to learn and do things in slightly off-site compounds where we can. We're also trying to drive down unnecessary complexities in the construction and really challenge, does, you know, a component or a piece of concrete need to be the highest safety class and the highest levels of paperwork and bureaucracy, and really think, how are we going to do this in the most efficient way possible?
Sure. Holtec, I've noticed just from your folks' website, I mean, you guys are getting interest. This is far beyond the United States. You're getting interest. And you, of course, you have competitors, we should note, and I think Mark was right to note, there's a lot of companies interested. There's nobody has a monopoly on this. But could you talk a little bit about interest abroad, North America as opposed to Europe, as opposed to Asia?
Yeah, sure. So I think Europe was kind of leading for a few years. They had like the very strong net zero push. And then kind of, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine happened, and everyone starts like having alarm bells. So the European, you know, with the power price, because I'm talking to you right now from the UK, and the power price in UK and Europe is just, it's about 2 to 3 times typically what you're seeing in the US. So there is a large drive towards basically low cost, reliable electricity, and that is coming from nuclear and renewables right now. So fossil fuels, especially in Europe, is just not giving a low price of electricity. So I'd say North America really started waking up about in the last 12 to 18 months, especially with the Inflation Reduction Act and all of the hype around that. now we're seeing a lot of interest from utilities, other owner operator companies who are starting to engage with us and say, hey, what does an SMR look like? Kind of what when can you get it on the grid? And then out into Asia, yeah, we're already having conversations with several countries. Although I'd say right now, our main focus as a company is in Europe and the US.
Okay. Mark, can you talk a little bit about the private money that is being drawn into this world? We have the project here in the Southwest that's being funded by the Utah Association of Municipal Power Systems. Los Alamos is actually part of that up at the Idaho National Laboratory. The Carbon Free Power Project, as a free market libertarian, I'm not pleased to say that the taxpayers have been committed to, I think, over $1 billion for that. But it also seems to me on the encouraging side, a lot of folks are interested from the private sector and willing to put some money up. Tell us a little bit about that. It's impressive to see interest from people willing to bet their own money, I guess is what I'm saying.
So Dowd, first of all, I want to comment on this by saying that you said, all right thinking Americans, let me say that nuclear is truly becoming a uniting issue where people from radically different parts of the political spectrums can find what they are dreaming of for the future in nuclear power, despite starting with very different, sometimes values. Oftentimes it's less that they're starting with different values. They have very different ideas of how human nature works or society or the way change happens, and yet they still come back to nuclear power. So if I could challenge you and say that, I hear you're a free market libertarian, let me just tell you that electricity is extremely weird and physically does not work like any of the other commodities it's often compared to, because it isn't really a commodity. It's a basic service, almost as if it's an oxygen for modern life. It's a heartbeat for industry and for the home. You might think of a strong nuclear fleet on a strong electricity grid as something like the rich soil that either a capitalist approach to wealth, socially democratic approach, depending on which, say, Northern European country is attempting this, can build a wealthy, harmonious society on top of the energy provided by nuclear. So just wanted to put that idea out of an energy garden that many things can grow from. And without that garden, you're not going to have that growth, regardless of which way you think you can pursue it. And there may be different ways to provide that garden. So let me talk about private money in nuclear first. I'm hearing more and more interest from the private realm. The discomfort is less about, say, squeamishness about nuclear waste or, you know, nuclear technologies, connection to bombs. I'm hearing that less and less. What I'm hearing more is a worry about the quality of projects available, the timelines that those projects have taken in the past, the variance in order to complete projects. So is it going to be 4 years like expected, or is it going to be 8 years, or is it going to be 12? Those are very different things for private lenders, and it's going to lead to really slow uptake on the private side of the project development, that is getting the nuclear plant built and then owning it, compared to what we're seeing a lot of, which is private investment in the companies designing and proposing nuclear reactor types. That's been incredible to watch. A lot of VC money, a lot of attention, a lot of energy being put into that side. What we need is customers, and customers that can get backing of, say, when you want to talk the big private money, we're talking about the private funds who have not just billions, but tens of billions to put into long-lived, useful, climate-proof industrial assets like nuclear plants, if only they had projects that they could believe in and a nuclear industry that could deliver what they say they can deliver. And by the way, that's the nuclear industry I hope to build. That's the one I want to work on. It's just, I understand why private money has been sitting on the sidelines to date, but I also want to challenge you as a libertarian to say there may be room to grow incredible liberty and freedom with government action to ensure a successful electricity program made off of nuclear. But we can debate and discuss maybe later. I just wanted to put that idea of an energy garden.
No, I certainly appreciate it, sir. I would also say that government gives and government taketh away. Government can be an asset for the industry, but government can be a tremendous impediment to the industry as well. And I love what you're saying about common ground, and I'm going to go back to Phil, our environmentalist. I doubt Phil and I agree on much of anything, but I'll challenge Phil, and I'll say, you know, there are still, despite the fact that, people who call themselves environmentalists, a good number are at least open, if not endorsing the nuclear option more and more, there's still a fair amount of real hardcore opponents. And I guess the question is, for me, is what will it take to convince those left-leaning environmentalists to come around on the issue of nuclear, where we are starting to see that common ground?
I think it's actually a generational issue. A lot of the old guard kind of left-leaning environmentalists have just been grown up and taught that nuclear is bad. And I think, to be kind of blunt, that frame of mind has to die out. And I think it will go with the retiring boomer generation, if you will. And I think our best path forward is to really instruct and talk to the youth in environmentalism, because I talk to younger people. The two things I found about nuclear is, one, they know absolutely nothing about it, and two, they are not scared of it. So it's a matter of kind of educating the younger cohort to support nuclear, and I think we are making a lot of progress, and I think especially some on the left are beginning to like realize that what they've been told about nuclear by their parents or the old guard is factually incorrect, and it's going to be a slow process, but that's what I try to do. But I'm a little bit more radical in that I consider anyone who is against nuclear as putting our future climate stability in jeopardy. So, I'll refer to them as more almost as climate deniers in a way, but for nuclear. So,
I think you're dead right on the generational issues, and any criticism of the baby boomers will be received very warmly by one D. Dowd Muska. The sooner we can get those people out of power, the better. I won't say anything beyond that, but they've really made a mess of things, haven't they, folks? I know there's some good boomers out there. I'm going to go back to Gareth on this issue of public acceptance. And Holtec International literally is the name of the company. Holtec International, you folks are all over the world, and you do a lot more than SMRs. So what are you seeing when you go out and you have to go not just before the regulatory boards, but you do public information forums and you get feedback. And certainly here in New Mexico, there's a separate nuclear project where I'm sure you folks get a lot of feedback, depending on what part of the state it is. Is Philip right about this issue of generational? Are we moving beyond that old China syndrome baby boomer era? Are we hopefully leaving that behind? And people are Zoomers, millennials, and my generation, the Xers, are we a little more rational when it comes to this?
Yeah, I think so. Like you said, we do a lot of public engagement. We're often in the front line of, especially when we're involved in projects, and there's interface either directly between us and the public or between our client and the public, and we attend and support the client as they're responding to them. And we're seeing a shift over the last, I'd say, 10 years as people, the younger generation start to, I don't want to speak out of turn, but I think the generation, and even I feel old right now because I'm seeing my kids grow up, but I think they just critically evaluate, and they have so much information on their hands, right, the touch of buttons, and as soon as you tell some kid about nuclear power, they start googling about it and they start like researching, and 5 minutes later they come back to you and they tell you five things that they've just learned. But I think that's the shift that I'm seeing, right, is that the younger generations are really starting to just see, process a lot more information and really evaluate kind of things on a sign more like black and white kind of basis, and really try and leave some of the opinions and historical kind of feelings and emotions. That's the, ultimately been a lot of the problems of nuclear. There's emotions get involved, and then there's all the scaremongering of these prior issues that we've had at several plants. I think as time goes on, we'll see that start to shift.
I hope so. It's tough. I've been to a lot of hearings over my lifetime, and the 2 days of regulatory hearings a couple of years ago about a different Holtec project, not the SMR here in New Mexico that were conducted. I sat through the Atomic Safety and Licensing Board hearings in Albuquerque a couple of years ago. Oh, we heard some wild comments, folks. Actually, they had bussed in activists. I'll reveal a little funny story. They had bussed in activists from, I think, all over the state, maybe even beyond the state. And one of the protesters in front of me turned to another one and said, What is this all about anyway? They were there to protest, but they literally didn't know what they were protesting. I think doesn't speak well to the anti-nuclear lobby at all. I'm going to kick it over to Mark and ask him about back on the government side, the regulatory side. It's one thing for the public to be more accepting of this. It's very difficult to change the culture and the habits and the behavior of regulators. Here in the United States, but also all throughout the developed world, the developing world, what does the regulatory landscape look like for SMRs or expansion of any type of nuclear? Are governments still stuck in the old ways with the regulatory ratcheting? Are they getting more nimble? I'm personally think that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, as regulatory agencies go, it's actually pretty good compared to, you know, its compatriots there. And a lot of the NRC is funded by the industry itself through fees. I think that's a pretty good model. But it seems to me, aside from public acceptance and raising the money, we've got to get good, sound regulations that don't strangle nuclear any more than it already has. What does that landscape look like to you?
Yeah, so first I wanted to comment a little bit about one of the previous topics, that generational fear. I want to challenge Gareth a little bit and say that nuclear justly will always produce strong emotions. That's why there's a concerted pro-nuclear movement that sprung up organically around the entire world, filled with people who get an immense amount of energy and joy and excitement out of pursuing pro-nuclear policies and advocating for nuclear energy. So I understood what you said, where you're saying that with fear, there can be sort of a shutting down of openness towards nuclear. But I want to say that nuclear energy is the most powerful energy ever harnessed by humanity. It deserves strong emotions. What's happening now, I think, is that these strong emotions on the negative side are fading. Even anti-nuclear people that I meet, young people, aren't afraid so much as they used to be. And I've met pro-nuclear people who are a little afraid of nuclear, but they are so enthusiastic about what nuclear brings. And you could say that, well, that's because they're rational and excited. Well, maybe. I don't quite know about the rationality, irrationality things. Anybody who's managed to survive through decades of life and not go hungry and then starve to death, and then somehow people get up in the morning and function. Somehow people have friends and family and homes and stuff. I think that people are rational enough to survive. It's reasonable to think that they have emotional connections to nuclear that are worth examining. And so I want to say I'm excited by how much other people are excited by nuclear, and I share that with people. And then people can find rational reasons to match with their emotions. And in fact, that's what I find. When people are really excited about nuclear, they dig deeper and deeper and deeper and get more and more excited. When people are very scared of nuclear, they find what you might think of as facts out of context or fear-based arguments, but they will find facts that seem to line up with being scared of nuclear. So I don't think we're ever gonna get away with it. There's just more and more enthusiasm for nuclear than fear of nuclear these days. So on the regulatory side, Dowd, that's a rare opinion you said, but I've got to back you up on it. In many ways, the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission is pretty darn good as regulators go internationally. It's not perfect, and there are things to improve, especially as regards to the acceptance, the rapid acceptance of newer technology, especially if it can be proven that reactors are small enough that their testing and even damage during operation would not pose an undue risk to the public. I think there is room for a faster path for reactors that are small enough. I would say this, the regulator does an amazing job working well with operators of existing plants to keep those plants safe and operational. In other countries, regulators have been given very bad missions, like make sure these plants are so deeply regulated that they'll probably have to shut off. When that mission is handed to a regulator, there's no reason for the regulator to be fast or responsive or even effective, because the end result of not moving quickly would be, say, shutting down nuclear plants. So in countries where that was the policy for a long time, like in France, I would not want to work with the regulator over there. The regulator demands things of their nuclear plants that are pretty silly and can end up leading to huge off periods for the nuclear plants that would not happen in the United States. So I think that the US Nuclear Regulatory Commission is also filled from top to, well, from bottom to nearly top with people who genuinely love and are interested in nuclear energy. In several key junctures in the startup of the most recent nuclear reactor to come online in the United States, the Vogtle plant, Vogtle 3 in Georgia, I know that the new NRC worked very rapidly to help make up for errors, not of their own, but errors in the plant builders. And I think that that proves to me that the US NRC does like nuclear and wants to see it succeed within its mandate to assure protection of people and the environment.
Sure.
So in terms of around the world though, what I'm particularly excited about is emerging countries setting up nuclear regulators, taking into account excellent international legal advice and best practices. So there's an emerging field of, I mean, you could call it advanced nuclear regulation, but there's a concern with portable regulation, where just like people want to be able to bring in jetliners to their countries without reinventing Boeing, the airliner producing company, instead they would like to bring in nuclear reactors, be able to competently and safely have them operate in their country, but not have to reinvent the wheel every single time with licensing. That, I think, is going to be the trend I'm watching over the next decade. Countries accepting leadership, advice, and licenses from existing nuclear countries when bringing technology into their own for the first time. And fortunately, there's incredible international cooperation, not just at the International Atomic Energy Agency, but several international organizations like INPO and WANO, World Association of Nuclear Operators. These are going to help new countries get up to speed and get new nuclear set up as rapidly as possible.
Excellent. I'm gonna blow Mark's mind even a little more by telling him I once wrote a small essay about some nuclear research going up at Los Alamos, the Kilopower, the crusty reactor, and I told the scientists working on that at a public presentation. I believe my quote was, "I have never said this to government employees before in my entire life, but congratulations on your brilliant work." So I think there can be, provided it's appropriate, a role for government in all this. And on the subject of the NRC, and Mark and I agree on that too. I've always been impressed with the people I've dealt with the NRC. It's worth mentioning, we are the Southwest Public Policy Institute. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has approved two consolidated interim storage facilities here in two adjoining counties, one in New Mexico, one in Texas. That's not what we're here to talk about, but it reminded me of the issue of nuclear waste, getting back specifically to the small modular reactor. And we're going to go ask Gareth about this, because it is one of their promotional pages for the SMR from Holtec is 80 years, on-site underground storage of used fuel from 80 or 100 years of operation. Gareth, talk a little bit about the spent fuel from your SMR and just SMRs in general. How it's produced, what is done with it, and what how the protections, the abundant protections that are going to be used to ensure public safety from SMRs in the same way that they've ensured public safety from spent fuel from the bigger plants for years and decades and decades.
Sure. So the small modular reactors, especially the ones that are kind of going to come on in the next decade, they're still using, like I said, the existing fleet technologies that we already see. So they have traditional fuel bundles coming out of the reactor after a few years, they will typically be reused again back in the reactor core until they're finally, maybe after two or three cycles, they don't have enough power to be worth using, and then they cool down in a pool for several years. And then what we do is we take them out of the pool and we put them in containers. We weld those containers shut. We dry them, fully seal the canisters, and then we put those canisters into modules. There's different technologies out there, and the one you saw on our website was where the modules are located just below ground level, and that just really helps drive down the radiation dose that is coming off. And we've deployed that system in California at San Onofre and at Callaway. So that's, but the container, the dry cask storage systems, this is a technology that the United States has been using since around the year 2000, and they've been doing it in Europe for a few years before that. And these canisters can be stored at the reactor site it depends on the atmospheric conditions, but we're talking hundreds of years. There's obviously a maintenance and monitoring program that goes on. And in terms of licensing, you typically get a license for 40 years of operation, and then you do a license extension after that. And we're sort of getting to that period now of the existing fleet where we're getting to that first license extensions are being processed for some of the reactors that are out there. But the SMRs are the same thing, especially the ones that, like I said, are coming up in the near term. We're all using the same fuel types, and we're going to be using the same management at the reactor sites using these canisters and casks.
We encourage you folks, we only got about 21 minutes left. Thanks for everybody who's commenting. We've got Ryan coming in on, he's giving a shout out for INPO. I think this organization Mark mentioned, he likes those folks. He says he's feeling grateful to all the nuclear energy workers out there showing up every day to power our country. And I think I can certainly sign on with that. I agree with Mark, this is naturally becoming an idea for broad human participation. So folks, whatever platform you're using to watch us right now, we appreciate your questions and your comments. So weigh in on that. Now, related to the issue of waste, when we talk about our friends on the environmental left, when they attack nuclear, it seems to be an argument that could be used against them is the overall environmental footprint, the impact of the nuclear industry versus solar and wind, which require big chunks of land, and of course the fossil fuel industry, which are environmentalist left friends hate. They think it's destroying the planet and yada yada, fracking. Phil, whether it's an SMR or a larger nuclear facility, in terms of the land, that the energy produced per land occupied by that facility, and also in terms of the ability to recycle spent fuel, some countries do it, we don't do it in the United States, in terms of mining the uranium versus mining something like coal, no matter how you really look at it, people can use different metrics, but boy, the environmental footprint, the disturbance footprint of nuclear is far, far less than the other methods we use to produce electricity. Why don't environmentalists or professional environmentalists seem to grasp that?
I think it is an ignorance of what energy density means. Nuclear is extremely energy dense. The amount of it's like fossil fuels are pretty dense energy, but consider nuclear, which is I think 6 million times more powerful per gram amount of fuel. That alone makes it so you just need a whole lot less inputs and other equipment to extract it. Just one small plant can, one large plant can do the same work as maybe 500 wind turbines because their capacity factor is pretty low. You just need a lot less, desert to be basically paved over with solar panels and stuff like that. And you just have to make less stuff to utilize the energy. And that means, you know, less manufacturing, less mining, and all sorts of things. So I think we need to kind of dial home, what does energy density mean? And energy density means less effect on the natural world for what we need. And I think it's, if we can push that message more, a lot more people will understand that and like give them visuals of like how much wind and solar would you have to use to, and batteries would you have to use to match just one small little nuclear plant. So, and I think we also have to realize that when it comes to waste in general, what the waste represents is millions of tons of carbon dioxide that has not been put in the atmosphere. And I think that needs to be kind of focused on. And I do think we do need a central place to put our waste. And I think the government, like, I think they're required to do that because the nuclear reactors have been paying money into a government fund for them to do something with it. And I think we need to eventually move towards a central location, like, you know, the interim storage in New Mexico and maybe eventually Yucca Mountain. So.
Sure. Yeah. The ratepayers have been paying into the nuclear waste fund for decades. And I think that payment might even be suspended right now because the federal government has bungled its responsibility. If you want to learn about government work, folks, the federal government was supposed to start receiving the spent nuclear fuel from our industry in January 1998. And not only are they not taking it, they don't even have a facility for it. We could get into the whole Yucca Mountain and Harry Reid issue, but that'll be a topic for another day. I'm going to kick it over to Mark. Question from John online, and I think it's an interesting question. I don't think nuclear technology has been reduced to the individual household level quite yet. We're not, maybe that's another, you know, century or so, Jetsons type stuff, but he wants to know what capacity in homes does a small modular reactor have. Mark, could you kind of tell us, in terms of how many homes, you know, what's the role for an SMR in terms of the size of a community it serves, and also remote locations and industrial applications and that kind of thing? We want to make sure people understand exactly what we're talking about. Unfortunately, we don't have that soda can reactor yet for each house, although, you know, I hope I live long enough to see it.
Yeah, so let's say that a home has an annual electricity demand of 10,000 kilowatt hours, so 10 megawatt hours per year per home. Well, a nice chunky modern reactor like the ones that Germany just foolishly turned off can supply about 10,000 gigawatt hours per year, so that's 10 million megawatt hours. So if you have, that's 1 million households at, say, an American rate of use of 10,000 kilowatt hours per year. So a small modular reactor like the ones being proposed, there's a lot of definitions thrown out there. Some people are talking about small modular reactors with a capacity of 1 megawatt, which means about just under, say, 10,000 megawatt hours per year. That would be about 1,000 homes in the case that we're talking about 10 megawatt hours per home. And then I suppose that the largest of the SMRs, like the ones that Slovakia is are already using, that are 470 megawatts electric capacity. This, at the rate of Slovakia's electricity usage, that probably powers about a million homes a year. So that's pretty cool. Now, there's something more important than just powering homes. Two things that I want to mention. One, when we hear about wind turbines being installed, we often hear this can power say 10,000 homes. Well, not really, because it goes off and on, right? So what's great about nuclear is that in a strong nuclear operating culture, Slovakia that uses INPO advice, that's the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, they use INPO international advice and best practices to get refueling periods, which are scheduled long in advance and are specifically targeted for the times of the year with the least amount of electricity demand. These outages can take, say, 18, 19, 20 days in countries getting used to this rapid, high quality operational technique. In the US, outages can take 2 weeks or even less. It's an extraordinary thing, these outages. So what that means is with only a few reactors, with ultra short outages that only happen once every 1.5 years and extremely rare or no emergency shutdowns for any kind of checks, then that means that you can truly power that number of houses. You can truly power 1 million households, not just sort of on average, because just like a heartbeat isn't any use to you if it's working on average, you need a heartbeat the whole year to stay alive. That's the way the grid is. You need the grid to work all the time, not just some of the time. One more thing. Go on. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say the old line about the on average, if your feet are in the refrigerator and your head's in the oven, on average, you're doing very well. So averages can be very deceptive.
Averages can be extremely deceptive. And in most countries that operate nuclear power plants, when it says it can power, say, 1 million homes or a fleet can power 10 million or 20 million, they mean it. It's actually powering homes and businesses year round.
Yeah, and it's also, Mark, the I'll put some, when we put this up on our website, folks, this the archive of this video, I will put up some of the information. I know the Nuclear Energy Institute puts their stats up. What the industry has done since the 1970s with the burn-up rate, increasing their power output, their capacity factors, they're up in the 90s now. The industry has just went from, you know, maybe it was rushed a little too early in those early decades, but boy, the industry has really grown up in the last couple of decades, and it's just doing dynamite things with its technology. And that old line about, you know, built by geniuses and operated by idiots, if that was ever true, it's certainly not true anymore. And I think it's suggestive of even greater things in the industry to come. I'm going to ask Gareth about what Holtec is hearing. We're talking different applications for this. All Holtec International is a global company. The potential customers for Holtec's SMR, what kind of people are, what size of governments, what types of jurisdictions are coming to you, what types of industries are coming to you? And then I got a question about the future, because as we head out into space with Elon, I hate to break it to the solar people, but solar panels are going to matter less and less and less the farther you get from the sun. And I think there's probably going to be a role for nuclear, you know, not next year or next decade, but maybe in 100 years from now. So can you tell us a little bit, Gareth, about, without naming names, if you don't want to reveal specific names, you know, where is that interest coming from or that Holtec is receiving for the different types of application for your technology?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, look, the interest is coming from both developed nations with, large capacity grids, and they're just looking for on-grid electricity, you know, like we've been talking about, reliable with high capacity factors year round, right? So the, you know, classic examples, US, Canada, Western Europe, they are approaching reactor technology developers like Holtec and saying, okay, when can you get this many megawatts or gigawatts on the grid, and how would that look? How would that program, especially the importance of like a fleet and a whole program of these reactors to drive that cost down. Then you get into like Eastern Europe, and it's more of like an industrial energy user driving the conversation out there. So they have some very, very large energy users who are using hundreds of megawatts every year, and they have balance sheets which can actually bankroll one of these projects. So, you know, we're talking to like heavy energy users, typically things like steel in parts of Eastern Europe, countries like Poland or Czech Republic, or Slovakia even, and that's really driving the conversation there. The other interesting thing I think I've seen recently, especially from the Western Europe and US and Canada, is data centers. I think we're going to start to see more conversations with them, and really some high tech companies which have a lot of money and they need a lot of power. And people don't realize like how much power is used by data centers. And you know, every time we're accessing the internet, there's a computer somewhere in a central location using power. So yeah, I think that's also going to drive the conversation very shortly.
Excellent. What about the way future? The way future, Gareth. Do you see as humanity expands? I know maybe Elon's timelines are not reality's timelines. He tends to be a little jump the gun a little bit about when we're going to be settling Mars. But certainly, in the decades to come, as we journey out, is there a role for SMRs or maybe super small SMRs in establishing those colonies beyond Earth?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's like we've been saying, it's a highly dense source of power. It's just got, at the moment, we've just configured it to really be suitable for the planet we live on. And there's a lot of these new generations of technologies, the Gen 4 technologies that are coming along, and I would say are going to be deployed in around 10 to 20 years time. And I think a lot of those will morph into technologies that could be, you know, put on other places and other planets. But I think the current technologies that we're talking about are typically, you know, suited for just large electricity or heat generation, you know, around us right now.
Sure. Folks, we are, 8-9 minutes left. I'm going to ask my last official question of Mark, and then we're going to spend the last few minutes with our three panelists on what you, the viewer, can do to support what we hope will be a nuclear revolution. This technology has been advancing in fits and starts through the last, 70 years. But boy, the potential is bottomless for this before we even get into the issue of fusion, which is a topic for another day. Mark, final question for you before we say our goodbyes. There's a lot of concern about supply chain issues, the international security situation. It's a little dicey. Nuclear might be one of the most globally integrated industries out there. Are there problems in that world, whether it's getting access at an affordable price for raw materials like steel and concrete, or even the more advanced stuff like pumps and valves and chips? Are those kind of issues that were made worse by lockdown? Another issue for another day. But you know, where do things stand? Is that serving to be a bottleneck for the advancement of the industry? Are those issues we need to address moving forward?
I would say I'm concerned less about the issues around lockdown and COVID and supply chain disruptions from that, and more about the bifurcation of the nuclear world in terms of the Russia war in Ukraine. So what that's done is it's sort of, well, it hasn't fully broken all ties, and certainly Russians and Americans work alongside each other in major international organizations still, almost by necessity. But in terms of the supply chains for reactors, supply chains for fuel, that's starting to rip wide open into the Russia and Russia customers world, and then the Western customers world. There's mostly, I don't have too many concerns about plants being fueled. I have even fewer concerns about plants being constructed. A number of Russian projects that were fairly far advanced in the project planning stage got stopped, kind of scrapped when the invasion started last year. And there's a number of countries very rapidly trying to diversify their Russian fuel supplies over to, say, Western European manufacturers like subsidiaries of Westinghouse that are based in Europe that can supply Soviet-designed fuel elements for Soviet-designed plants in Central and Eastern Europe. So that certainly is happening. There's a lot of discussion, both on the anti-nuclear side of the argument and pro-nuclear side, whether it is correct or it's strategic to completely stop all flow of Russian enriched uranium supplies to the West. People make good arguments on both sides for both yes and no. And of course, Russia, if they wanted to, could cut off supplies at any time, but it would out them as an unreliable supplier if they did that unilaterally. So everybody has a lot of skin in the game and at the moment are just trying to quietly diversify. You asked mainly about the construction part. So like maybe concrete, not so worried about concrete. Steel, not too worried about steel. In terms of reactor forging, so giant chunks of metal slammed into shape to build the largest parts in nuclear plants, because some of the parts you need to make for small modular reactors are bigger than some of the parts you need for the large modular reactors. You can't really tell just from the marketing term whether you need big parts or small parts. It really depends on the design of the plant. Well, I think there's pretty good forging capacities between those worlds, even though I would like to see more forges in the US for sure as a proud American. I think that in terms of the pumps and valves, there's pretty independent supply chains too, because nuclear is considered quite strategic. It's not that we have all those in the United States, but between the United States and Europe, we have a lot of what we'll need to get started building new nuclear plants. And the Chinese have theirs, and the Russian have theirs too. Now, I don't know the full details about whether Russian projects are at all being disrupted by any limitations on technology imports from the West. At the moment, I've only heard that there's continued progress in many of the world's exported nuclear plants, which are Russian in design and are Russian projects. So Russia is by far the world's most prolific builder of nuclear plants for third countries. And I have not heard of those projects being delayed to date.
Okay. Folks, we are desperately low on time. I'm going to go to Phil, Gareth, and then Mark for final thoughts. What I'd like to hear from each of our guests, we've had three really solid ones today, is, you know, this issue in some ways is so prosaic. You just flick on the lights and the electricity comes on. But on the other end, it's also, we're talking about physics. We're talking about neutrons. We're talking about cesium and strontium. We're talking about regulations and international supply chains. People can feel very distant from this. They don't, you know, what can I do? If you are pro-nuclear, or even if you just want more information, you want to participate in this debate, how can you pitch in? You're not a scientist. You're not an engineer. You're not a regulator. What role does the average person play, the average pro-nuclear person or the average interested in nukes person? What can they do? And I'm sure much of it will be linked to your own individual work. We'll go to Phil first, and then we'll go to Gareth, and then Mark to wrap things up. What should the average person do to get involved in this?
Don't get overwhelmed, and I'd say just when you're having conversations about energy and climate, people always bring up the word nuclear and ask them what they think about it. And if you have facts on it that you can recite, that's great. And I think it's one of the biggest things you can do right now is just move the social conversation, because nuclear is often just excluded from the news and stuff like that, nuclear power. And I think that's, especially in climate conversations, because climate change is getting serious, I believe. And I think, you know, people are like, oh, we haven't really decreased emissions that much. And the reason is we've left something off the table. And I think we should really push the idea that if you're concerned about climate change, you got to be consistent in all science and support nuclear power. But what the average Joe can do about it, just talk to people, talk to your loved ones, talk to friends, whenever you have this energy conversations come up, just bring up the word nuclear, because it's not mentioned as much as it should. But when it comes to finding some resources, I'm not going to toot my own horn because I don't have that many resources on my website, but there is a website called What is Nuclear by my friend Nick Turan, and he's a engineer, and that has a great starting point information for anything nuclear on it. So let's head over there.
Excellent, excellent. Gareth, other than visiting the Holtec International website, which has so much great resources about what your company does beyond SMR, guy in the street, gal on the street, they want to participate in this. What should they do?
I think it's like Phil was saying, just don't be afraid to talk about nuclear, especially if you're having a conversation around, net zero and climate change. I think it's, trying to get the message out there, social media, these kinds of forums, going into schools, also trying to raise the awareness and raise the word nuclear at things like, the COP. So like COP 28, we need to get nuclear at the forefront of that. That's really been a shift over the last few years.
Yeah, and I remember reading a couple of years ago, there was a communique at the end of one of those COPs, and they didn't even mention nuclear. I know there were a lot of nuclear people who were not happy about that big Mack truck-sized hole. Mark, your final thoughts. What can a regular American, Brit, Slovakian, Brazilian do to help this movement?
Find other people who also like nuclear. Find a way to get a hold of them, either in chat rooms or group messages, and then figure out what the next best step is for your community, your country, or your continent. I know that I'm involved in a lot of different WhatsApp-based communities where people get together and they work on this. So if somebody wants to ask me if there's one in their region already, or if they should start one, just get a hold of me. Best way to do it is through direct messages on Twitter at EnergyBands.
Very, very good. Great discussion, gentlemen. I can't thank you enough. And of course, thank you to the viewers for tuning in. We will be back next Friday for more SPPI TV. And as you wait for that next episode, go to southwestpolicy.com. Our mission, as I like to say, is to preserve what's good about the American Southwest, the eight great states of the American Southwest, and fix what the problems are and continue to hold up our part of the country as a beacon for good policymaking. And that produces a good quality of life for a lot of folks who love living here in the American Southwest. Southwestpolicy.com. And of course, we'll have the archive of this video up later today as well. Thanks, folks. And we will talk to you again next Friday. Thank you so much.